The key had led her nowhere at the factory, nowhere at the tenement, and nowhere in the 3 days since she'd lifted it from the evidence pile at Broome Street. But Brass was honest, even when its owner wasn't. Pearl held it up to the November light filtering through the cab window and watched the wear patterns catch the dull glow. The bow was smoothed flat from grip pressure. The teeth were cut in a standard pattern, yes, but the depth varied in a way that suggested custom modification. Someone had filed those teeth down, selectively, to fit a lock that didn't exist on any factory floor. She'd taken this observation to Sergeant Doyle, who'd listened with the patient condescension reserved for women who insisted on being useful. "Custom locks," he'd said, stirring sugar into coffee that didn't need it. "There are dozens of locksmiths in the city, Miss Casey. Your machinist friend might have carried a personal key for his locker, his tools, his home. You're chasing ghosts." But ghosts didn't leave oil stains. Pearl paid the driver at the corner of Orchard and Rivington and stepped into a street that smelled of wet brick and something sharper machine oil, the kind used on milling equipment, thick and mineral and stubborn. She'd smelled it before in the factory yard on Thomas Erickson's hands the day she'd interviewed him. But here, cutting through the damp air of the Lower East Side, it was fresher. Recent. The machine shop sat between a laundromat and a boarding house, a narrow two-story building with a corrugated iron facade that had rusted into a uniform shade of burnt orange. There was no sign above the door. The windows were painted shut with layers of white paint, cracked and flaking like sunburned skin. Pearl pressed her palm against the wall beside the entrance and felt the damp cold of the brick, then wiped it on her coat and looked at her fingers. Brown residue. Rust, maybe. Or dried oil mixed with grime. The door was locked, obviously. Pearl tried the handle anyway, out of habit, then crouched to examine the lock mechanism. It was an old mortise lock, brass-plated, the kind that required a heavy key and a heavier hand. And there, on the surface of the metal, she saw it a thin smear of fresh oil, dark and glistening, caught in the keyhole and smeared across the escutcheon plate like a thumbprint. She touched it, her finger came away black. Someone had been here recently. Within hours, maybe. The oil hadn't dried or collected dust. It sat on the surface like something freshly applied, deliberate and careless at the same time. Pearl stood and surveyed the building. 2 stories, narrow footprint, a chimney stack that hadn't smoked in years. Through the grimy lower window, she could make out the silhouette of machinery inside a lathe, maybe, or a milling machine, its shape distorted by dirt and distance. The place had been abandoned, officially or otherwise. But the fresh oil on the lock told a different story. Someone was using it. She walked around the perimeter, keeping to the alley where the garbage hadn't been collected and the smell was worse than the street. The back of the building had a loading door, wider than the front entrance, with a different lock entirely, a padlock on a hasp, heavy iron, rusted through at the shackle. It had been cut recently. The metal edges were bright where the bolt had been severed, oxidizing fast in the damp air. Pearl knelt and examined the cut. Clean, professional. A hacksaw, not bolt cutters. Someone who knew their tools. Inside the loading area, the floor was packed earth, uneven and stained with patches of something dark and viscous. Pearl struck a match, cupped it against the wind, and peered inside. The flame illuminated a space filled with shadows and the skeletal remains of industrial equipment. A workbench along the far wall. Shelves bolted to the brick, mostly empty, and scattered across the floor footprints. Not the random scuffing of someone who'd wandered through. These were deliberate, a trail leading from the loading door to the workbench, then back again. The prints were size 9 or 10, narrow heel, the tread pattern of a dress shoe rather than a work boot. Someone had walked this floor recently enough that the dust hadn't settled over their steps. Pearl blew out the match and replaced it in her box. She didn't need more light. She'd seen what she needed. The workbench was the key, literally and figuratively. She circled back to the front door and found a gap in the paint where the window sash had been forced open and poorly receded. Standing on her toes, she reached through, worked the latch loose, and pulled the window up enough to slip through. Glass crunched under her boots as she dropped into the main room. The interior was colder than the outside, the air stagnant and thick with the smell of old oil and something else, machine grease, yes, but underneath it, the sour tang of mildew and forgotten things. Pearl pulled her coat tighter and moved toward the workbench, her boots whispering against the dust-covered floor. The bench itself was solid oak, scarred by decades of blade marks and hammer strikes. On its surface, arranged with an orderliness that contradicted the surrounding decay, lay three items: a small leather notebook, a brass caliper, and a folded sheet of paper. Pearl picked up the notebook first. The cover was cracked, the pages yellowed with age, but the handwriting inside was fresh, dark ink, precise script, entries dated within the last week. October 28, tested the new cutter, holds edge. November 2, received shipment, quality acceptable. November 5, lock mechanism functional, key cut. November 5, 3 days ago, the same day Thomas Erickson had gone missing. Pearl's pulse quickened, she flipped further. The entries became less frequent, more terse. "Then we'll have to discuss your principles," Vane said, his voice smooth as polished brass. "I find they're often cheaper than gold." November 8, inspection avoided, new contact established. November 10, payment received, proceeding. November 10, yesterday. She set the notebook down carefully and picked up the brass caliper. It was a precision instrument, the kind used by machinists for measuring tolerances to fractions of an inch. The jaws were closed, the scale reading zero. Pearl opened it, examined the engraving on the beam. H. Garment & Sons, Est 1872. The name meant nothing to her, but the craftsmanship was solid, American-made, likely local. A shop that had been around long enough to earn trust and old enough to be forgettable. That was the point, she realized. Garment & Sons wasn't a front. It was a ghost. A business that had existed, perhaps still existed on paper, but operated in the spaces between legitimate enterprises. The kind of shop that could produce modified keys, custom-cut lock mechanisms, and whatever else someone with the right connections needed without drawing attention. The folded paper was a receipt. Pearl unfolded it carefully, the creases cracking in the dry air. It listed three items: a mortise lock mechanism, a set of custom-cut keys, and a padlock with cutting service. The date at the bottom was November 5. The signature at the bottom was illegible, a flourish that might have been an H or a G, hard to tell with ink that had bled into the paper fibers. But the address at the top was clear: 147 Orchard Street, basement level. Pearl slipped the receipt into her coat pocket, along with the caliper. She left the notebook on the bench, too dangerous to carry, too obvious to destroy. Let whoever had been here come back and find it gone, or find it here and wonder who'd been watching them. She was climbing back through the window when she heard it, the sound of footsteps on the street outside, measured and unhurried, approaching the front door. Pearl froze, pressing herself against the wall beside the window frame, her breath shallow and controlled. Her father's voice in her head: walk like a shadow, be the space between things. The footsteps stopped at the door. A key turned in the lock, the same key that fit the mortise lock, the same key that might fit the locks in Celia's Vane's private office, the same key that had been sewn into Thomas Erickson's hem. The door opened. A man entered. Pearl couldn't see him from her angle, but she heard the scrape of his shoe on the floor, the soft click of the door closing behind him. He moved toward the workbench. She heard the notebook lift, turn, set down again. A low whistle, not a tune, just a sound of assessment, of someone noticing that things had been disturbed. Then his voice, low and calm: whoever you are, you're taking your time. Pearl's hand went to the small revolver she kept in her coat, a .32 caliber, inherited from her father, three rounds remaining. She'd told herself she wouldn't need it. She was reconsidering. The man stepped toward the window, toward her. Pearl dropped back into the alley, rolled once on the wet ground, and ran. The townhouse stood on Fifth Avenue like a judgment. Pearl stood at the iron gate and looked up at three stories of brownstone and bad decisions. She had told herself she was going to force an audience. She had rehearsed a speech about public interest and the rights of the deceased's family. The speech evaporated somewhere between the carriage drive and the brass knocker. This was not a building you forced your way into. This was a building that decided whether you were allowed inside. A servant appeared at the door before she could ring. Young boy, maybe 16, uniform too large, eyes wide the way servants' eyes were when they'd been told what to expect and still weren't ready for it. "Miss Casey," he said. "I didn't send for you," Pearl said. "No, miss, Mr. Vane sent for you. He said you'd come." He held the door open. Pearl stepped through. The interior smelled of beeswax and expensive tobacco, the kind of tobacco that cost more per pound than a machinist earned in a week. A grand piano played scales somewhere in the next room, someone practicing, someone with time to waste on choppin' while men died on the East River. The sound was precise, metronomic, annoying. Pearl's jaw tightened. "The parlor, miss," the boy said, gesturing down a hallway lined with paintings Pearl didn't recognize and didn't care to. "He's been waiting." Pearl followed him into a room that had been designed to make people feel small. High ceiling, dark wood paneling, a fireplace large enough to stand inside. Selah's Vane sat in an armchair by the hearth, one leg crossed over the other, holding a teacup the way a man holds a weapon he intends to use gently. He was 52, platinum-haired, blue-eyed, dressed in charcoal wool that probably cost more than Pearl's annual income. He looked at her the way a man looks at a chess piece he's already decided how to move. "Miss Casey," he said. His voice was smooth, aristocratic, never raised above a conversational murmur. "Please, sit." She didn't sit. She stood in the center of the rug and let him watch her do it. "You sent for me," she said. "I did." He set his teacup on a side table, porcelain clicking against porcelain. The piano in the next room shifted to a new scale. "I understand you've been asking questions about Thomas Erickson's death." "That's one way to put it." Another smile, small practiced. "I admire directness, it's rare, especially in women." The comment landed like a stone dropped into still water. Pearl felt the ripple move through her shoulders, down her spine. She kept her face flat. "What do you want, Mr. Vane?" "Tea?" He tilted his head toward the tray on the side table. "Silver pot, crystal glasses, a plate of shortbread that looked untouched. I find tea clarifies the mind. Though I suspect you're not here for refreshment."
"No."
"Good." He uncrossed his legs, leaned forward slightly. The movement was economical, like a predator deciding whether to stand. "Then let me be equally direct. Thomas Erickson was a machinist at my mill. He was also, apparently, a man who took things that didn't belong to him." Pearl's hand went instinctively to her pocket. The .32 was there, three rounds. She'd checked this morning before leaving the boarding house. She always checked. "I'm not here to threaten you," Vane said, reading her gesture with the ease of a man who'd been read like this before. "I'm here to offer you something." He reached into his jacket pocket. Pearl's fingers closed around the revolver. He moved slowly, deliberately, withdrew a folded envelope and placed it on the table between them. The envelope was thick, cream-colored, sealed with wax. $500, he said. "In bills, unmarked. You take it, you close your investigation, you go back to whatever else occupies your considerable energy. Simple." Pearl stared at the envelope. $500. It was more money than she'd held at once in her entire 29 years. It was also the exact amount that made her feel like a thing being weighed on a scale. "And if I refuse?" Vane's smile didn't waver. "Then I'll have to assume you're not interested in money, which means I'll need to try something else." The piano shifted again, a new piece this time, something faster, more agitated. Pearl noticed it for the first time. Someone was playing in the next room while this conversation happened. A student? A musician employed by Vane? Or was the piano player there as an audience? She looked at Vane's hands. Clean nails. No calluses. The hands of a man who'd never held a file or turned a lathe in his life. "You want me to drop the case?" she said. "I want you to make a rational decision. Erickson was murdered." "Was he?" Vane tilted his head. "The coroner said drowning. Accidental. You're an independent contractor, Miss Casey, not sworn in, no badge, no authority. Who gave you the right to reinterpret a coroner's verdict?" The question was a blade wrapped in velvet. Pearl felt it slide under her ribs and twist. "Nobody gave me anything," she said. "I took the right." Vane's expression didn't change, but something shifted behind his eyes, a calculation, a reassessment. He'd expected fear. He'd gotten defiance. That required a new variable. "You're persistent," he said. "I'll give you that. Your father was the same way. Michael Casey, brilliant man, tragic end, really, a fall from a clock tower. How did that happen again?" The temperature in the room dropped 5 degrees. Pearl's breath caught. She'd spent 3 years building a wall around that memory, stacking bricks of routine and denial and work until nothing visible remained. Vane had kicked a hole in it with one sentence. "You know about my father," she said. It wasn't a question. I know everything worth knowing about anyone worth knowing, Vane said. His voice was still quiet, still smooth. Your father dug into things he shouldn't have. He thought he was smarter than the people who own the buildings he investigated. He wasn't. You have his talent, Miss Casey, but you don't have his judgment. Pearl's fingers tightened on the revolver. 3 rounds. Against a man sitting in an armchair with servants in the hall and a piano player in the next room. The math was insulting. Why are you telling me this? She said. Because I want you to understand the stakes. He leaned back again, recrossed his legs. Thomas Erickson was digging too. He found something at the mill, something that belongs to people far more important than a machinist with a family and a conscience. He took a key that opens doors best left shut. The key, he knew about the key. You've been watching me, Pearl said. Everyone watches everyone in this city, Miss Casey. It's the only way to stay alive. He tapped the envelope with one finger. $500. Think of what it would do for you. A new wardrobe, a proper office, maybe even a horse that doesn't cough. The insult was casual, almost affectionate. Like a man patting a dog he intended to keep or shoot depending on the day. Pearl's mouth twisted. My horse doesn't cough, she said. He limps. Vane smiled wider, cute but irrelevant. Pearl looked at the envelope. $500, enough to breathe for a year, enough to buy silence from anyone who asked questions about where it came from, enough to walk away. She thought of Alina Rossi sweeping the same patch of floor on the fourth flight. Of Marco, 7 years old, hiding under a bed while men in gray coats stood outside his door. Of Thomas Erickson, dead in a morgue on Draper Street, a key sewn into his hem like a message in a bottle thrown into a river that was already full of corpses. She thought of her father, falling from a clock tower. You know about my father, she said again, quieter this time. How do you know about my father? Vane's eyes flickered, just for a fraction of a second, a crack in the porcelain. New York is a small city, Miss Casey. It's not that small. No, he stood. The movement was sudden, decisive. The conversation had reached its natural conclusion. It's small enough. He walked past her toward the door, close enough that she could smell the tobacco on his coat, the faint scent of lavender water beneath it. He stopped at the threshold, turned back. The envelope stays, he said. Take it or leave it. But understand this, if you continue investigating, you're not just fighting a murderer, you're fighting me, and I have resources you cannot imagine. The piano in the next room stopped. Silence rushed in like water filling a hull. Pearl looked at the envelope, then at Vane, then at the door. I don't imagine many things, she said. That's kind of the point. Vane studied her for a long moment, then he nodded once and walked out. The servant appeared at the hallway entrance, waiting, watching. Pearl's hand stayed on the revolver. She counted to 10 in her head, slow and steady, then turned and walked to the door. She didn't take the envelope. Outside, the November wind hit her like a slap. Pearl stepped over the threshold and onto the sidewalk, her boots clicking against the cobblestones. She didn't look back. She walked fast, head down, the wind pushing her toward Broome Street and the station house and whatever came next. Her pocket felt empty without the key. She'd left it in her other coat, in the boarding house drawer, buried beneath a stack of laundry. But the weight in her chest was heavier than any brass object. $500. Vane's voice. The way he'd said her father's name like it was a tool he'd already used on someone else. She turned the corner onto Fifth and kept walking. The city roared around her, carriages clattering, vendors shouting, the distant rumble of an elevated train overhead. Somewhere in the city, a man was dead because he'd found something he shouldn't have, and Selah's Vane wanted her to forget. Pearl Casey never forgot anything. That was her gift and her curse. She'd spent her whole life trying to prove she was more than her father's daughter. Now Vane was reminding her that she might never escape being him. She pulled her collar tighter against the wind and kept moving. The envelope sat on the table in Vane's parlor, unopened, unclaimed. It would wait there until he decided to retrieve it or dispose of it. Either way, it wasn't hers. Not today. But the question wasn't whether she wanted the money. The question was whether she could afford not to spend it eventually. Because $500 was a lot of nothing, and nothing was the one thing Pearl Casey couldn't survive. The street grew loud and chaotic. Pearl didn't hurry. Hurrying made you look guilty. She walked at a steady pace, shoulders squared, eyes forward, the damp chill seeping through her wool coat as she headed toward the Bowery and whatever Alina Rossi might tell her next. Behind her in the townhouse on Fifth Avenue, the piano started playing again. A different piece this time. Slower, darker, a funeral march disguised as practice. Pearl didn't look back. She didn't need to. She already knew what the music sounded like. It sounded like a threat. And threats, she'd learned, were just promises that hadn't kept their appointment yet. She reached the corner of 5th and 13th and paused. A carriage passed, splashing mud against her boots. She wiped her face with the back of her glove, rain, sweat, the salt of something she wouldn't name. Then she turned south and kept walking. The key was still out there. Vane had it, or someone he trusted did. And if Vane knew about the key, he knew about the lock it opened. Which meant the lock was important. Which meant the door behind it held something worth killing for. Pearl's jaw set. She'd spent 3 days running in circles, following leads that dissolved like sugar in rain. Now she had a direction, not a destination, a direction. And directions were better than nothing. She would find out what that key opened. And when she did, she would be ready. Ready or not, the door was coming. She just had to make sure she was on the right side of it when it opened. The rain fell harder. Pearl pulled her hat lower and disappeared into the gray afternoon, the way she always did, alone, uninvited, and absolutely unwilling to leave. Behind her, the townhouse on Fifth Avenue went quiet. The piano stopped. The servant closed the parlor door. The envelope sat on the table, cream-colored, sealed, waiting. Inside, Silas Vane poured himself another cup of tea and looked out the window at the empty street. "Interesting girl," he said to no one. He didn't sound worried. He sounded amused. Which was worse? His hand rested on the edge of the windowsill. Beneath his palm, carved into the wood in tiny, precise letters, was a single word: Casey. He'd had it put there the day Pearl's father died. A reminder, a promise, both. Vane smiled, took a sip of tea, and listened to the rain. Some games took years. He had time. But Pearl Casey didn't. That was the difference between them, and it was the only reason she might win. The rain continued. The street emptied. The townhouse stood silent on Fifth Avenue, a monument to patience and power and the terrible arithmetic of class. Inside, Vane set his cup down. The china clicked against the saucer. Then he turned away from the window and walked into the next room, where the piano waited, untouched, for a player who would never sit at its keys again. The scales had stopped. The room was still. And somewhere in the city, a woman with a .32 and three rounds was walking toward a door she didn't yet know how to open. The key was brass, worn at the bow, teeth cut in a standard pattern. But the lock it fit, that was non-standard. And it was waiting. Pearl felt it in her bones, the way she felt everything that mattered. Certain, heavy, and impossible to ignore. She kept walking. The city swallowed her whole. And Silas Vane, in his townhouse on Fifth Avenue, closed his eyes and smiled. Because he knew something she didn't. The key didn't open his office. It opened his basement. And what was down, there wasn't a ledger or a contract or a document. It was a body. His body. No, not his. Someone else's. And Pearl Casey was walking straight toward it. She just didn't know it yet. The rain fell, the street cleared, the townhouse stood. And the game continued. Pearl reached the Bowery at 4 o'clock. The tenement looked the same as it had 3 days ago, gray, tired, indifferent to the weather or the people trapped inside it. She climbed the stairs slowly, listening. Her boots made no sound on the warped wood. She'd learned that trick from her father, who taught her to walk like a shadow before she could read. The stairs groaned at the third landing. A long, metallic shriek that echoed up through the building like a scream muffled by plaster. Apartment 4, door slightly ajar. Pearl pushed it open with two fingers. Alina was inside, kneeling on the floor, a child's shoe in her hand. She looked up when Pearl entered, her hazel eyes wide, her black hair loose and tangled. "They came back," she said. Her voice was rapid, anxious, Italian cadence sharpening every consonant. "Two men, gray coats. They stood outside again. I heard them talking. Not English. not Italian, something else. Pearl crouched beside her. What did they say? Elena shook her head. I couldn't understand, but one of them said a name. She hesitated, looked at Marco, who was hidden behind the sofa, clutching a wooden toy soldier. My husband's name, Thomas. Pearl's stomach tightened. Did they leave? No, they're still there, I think. Elena set the shoe down. Her hands were shaking. Pearl, you can't keep coming here. They're watching you. They'll watch you here too, and then they'll come in. I need to know what they're looking for. Looking for? Elena's voice cracked. They're not looking, they're waiting, there's a difference. Pearl stood, walked to the window, looked down at the street below. Two figures stood across the road, hands in pockets, faces turned upward, gray coats. Still, patient. They're not leaving, she said. Elena stood too, crossed the room in three quick steps, grabbed Pearl's arm. Her grip was surprisingly strong. Then you have to leave, she said. Now, before they decide you're the answer to whatever question they're waiting for. Pearl looked at Alina's hand on her arm, at the desperation in her face, at Marco, still hiding behind the sofa, still watching. She thought of Vane's envelope, sitting unclaimed on a table in a townhouse 3 miles away. $500, a simple solution, a clean exit. She thought of the key in her drawer at the boarding house. Brass, worn, standard teeth, non-standard lock. She thought of her father, falling from a clock tower because he'd asked too many questions. I can't leave, she said. Yes, you can, Elena said. You just have to want to live more than you want to know the truth. Pearl held her gaze. The window rattled in its frame. Somewhere downstairs, a door slammed. The men in gray coats hadn't moved. Pearl turned away from the window, walked to the door, paused on the threshold. Stay inside, she said. Don't answer for me, don't answer for anyone. Elena nodded. Her eyes were wet, but she didn't cry. Not here, not now. Pearl stepped into the hallway, closed the door behind her. She descended the stairs two at a time, her heart hammering against her ribs, her hand on the .32 in her coat pocket. She burst out onto the street and crossed it fast, keeping her head down, moving toward the corner where she'd left her horse. Behind her, apartment 4's window opened. Elena's face appeared, pale against the gray light. Pearl didn't look back. She mounted the horse, kicked it into motion, and rode south into the rain, the men in gray coats watching her go, the key burning in a drawer 3 miles north, and Selah's Vane smiling in a townhouse on Fifth Avenue, because he knew something she didn't. The game was already over. She just hadn't received the letter yet.